First, a few things about Unknown Country. We will be keeping up with coronavirus very carefully. What we're trying to do is to find important information that is verified, but that is not generally known. And this is what our coronavirus reports will concentrate on, including the one I'm about to deliver in a few moments. Second, we are increasing the level of community on our website. There will be Zoom meetings for subscribers on Saturday mornings at 10 a.m. Pacific. This appears to be the best time for everybody all over the world who is involved with Unknown Country. And then there will be live meditations on the YouTube channel on Thursday evenings at 7 p.m. These live meditations will go up on YouTube on the regular channel about 24 hours after they appear. A little information about Zoom. Zoom is a video meeting platform. And what will happen when we're on Zoom is that I'll start out and do a meditation and a brief discussion. And then all of us who are on Zoom together in the same meeting will be able to talk to each other using video. Now, you can get the Zoom app for your Android or Apple phone on their respective app stores. It's called the Zoom Meeting app or Zoom Cloud Meetings. There are other apps, but don't get them because they're not going to work right. Now, if you're on a computer, you can go to the Zoom website and you can take it from there. It's extremely simple to use and very reliable. If you want to speak in the meetings, you will need a microphone that works on your computer, obviously. If you do or don't want to be seen, that's up to you. You can turn your video off or on. And it is a very pleasant way to meet and also to exchange ideas and information. Now to go on to our coronavirus update for this week, and we will revise this during the week if necessary. First, there was a White House briefing on Thursday, March the 18th, stating that there was concern about younger people now because there are reports of cases in France and Italy where younger people have become much more seriously ill. However, bear in mind that younger people in France and Italy also smoke heavily. And like in China there and Asia in general, there are many, many more heavy smokers there than there are here. So that might not be as serious here, but beware. Be careful and be aware that if you are young, even if you are young, you are not necessarily immune to this. Now, what I would like to do is to give a rundown of how long the virus remains on surfaces and in the air. A study developed by the National Institutes of Health, the U.S. Department of Defense, and a number of others. These are how long the virus lingers in the air. It can linger up to 3 hours. Obviously, it blows around in the air. So while maintaining safe distance of 6 feet away from other people while you're out, it is also wise to go out as little as possible, just as they are recommending. On plastic, and this is plastic dishes, plastic anything, plastic, all kinds of plasticware, it can linger up to 3 days. So you need to wash this material carefully. You don't need to necessarily disinfect it as long as you wash it with detergent and water. If you don't have any detergent, then use soap and water. There's plenty of soap around, although there's some of the stores are, their shelves are bare of any kind of detergent. On copper, it lingers for 4 hours. On stainless steel, for 3 days. Now, here's a very important one that few people are aware of. It lingers on cardboard for 24 hours. Everybody is buying supplies from Amazon and other online retailers. Bear in mind that you should use very careful protocols when you handle those boxes. If you have gloves, use gloves. If you do not have gloves, immediately after handling a box, wash your hands or use hand sanitizer if you're not in a place where you can wash your hands. If you don't know how to make hand sanitizer, go on the internet and Google it. It's not difficult. 70% alcohol is preferable to 91% alcohol because the water in it makes it better, a better cleaner. That is, and you mix it with aloe. It's quite simple, and there is still plenty of aloe and isopropyl alcohol around. Don't use vodka. It doesn't work. There's not enough alcohol in it. And if you have no hand sanitizer, no gloves, and no access to soap, then when you touch the box, use something between your fingers and the box. Use a tissue or anything, even a piece of newspaper that you know has not been touched by anybody else, such as the interior part of an old newspaper. But do not handle cardboard boxes if you know that they have been in somebody else's hands within 24 hours. And after you have opened them, put them in a safe place for at least overnight. Don't leave them around the house. Consumer Reports has an excellent online coronavirus update hub that contains a lot of reliable information. This is where we found the information about the time it lingers on various surfaces. Now, let's talk about something else, slightly different. If the internet should go down, now, this is a possibility because obviously it is stressed. It is, however, very durable, and it is quite likely that it will come up again soon. So if you suddenly lose the internet, it would be wise if you're like those of us who live in earthquake zones and have a little portable radio handy if you don't have access to an antenna for your television or anything like that. A lot of people are just streaming everything. I know, nowadays. So if the internet went down, I would lose all access to television and obviously my website, et cetera, and so forth. What I would do would be to turn on my little portable radio and simply wait for news to see what's going to happen next. Now, obviously, it will come back again, because if that happens, if there's a backbone issue because of stressing of the system because so many people are using it, that could happen. And it could happen spottily as well in certain areas and then be brought back again. I don't think it's a major issue, but it's going to be scary if it happens. I am just suggesting don't panic. Now, where are we with this? Well, so far, the number of cases is increasing, but there's not a lot of evidence that it's going to overwhelm the healthcare system in the United States yet. It may. I wouldn't say that that's impossible. But the effort that the country is making to isolate itself and to reduce the number of cases and the amount of spread is pretty dramatic. And it might work. After all, it worked in China with far more cases, a far less willing population, and a far less healthy population as well, because smoking is a very big issue in coronavirus. If you smoke, you're definitely more likely to get this. Also, if you have high blood pressure or diabetes, it's more dangerous, or something like COPD, then it's very dangerous. If you have any of these issues in your body, really be extremely serious about staying away from other people. Isolate yourself as best you can. If you're an older person with any of these issues and living alone, find a neighbor or a friend or a family member to do your shopping for you and leave your shopping at the door. Also, shop wisely. Buy things that you can get a lot of for not a lot of money and that will last. For example, the moment I realized that this coronavirus was spreading, I went to the store and bought 5 pounds of dried beans, which for a guy living alone is a lot of dried beans. I'm going to be in beans for quite a long time with that amount. And they're simple to prepare. They're very good if you're a diabetic. You can prepare, if you have an Instant Pot, it just takes a few minutes to make a very nice batch of dried beans. And there are all kinds of lovely recipes for beans. You can cook them on the stovetop as well very easily, and they store dry essentially forever. so you don't need to refrigerate them or anything like that. Same is true of rice. There's lots of rice around, at least there is where I live, and it's nutritious, and a beans and rice dish, it's a classic dish. The two of them together give you a very solid meal, and if you can add some veggies, all the better. And as always, you can write me at whitley@struber.com. If you're a subscriber and having any issues, you can go to subscribers, write to subscribers at unknowncountry.com. This is a community, and that's what it's been conceived of by Ann Struber from the very beginning, as a community for people with unusual experiences that would cut through the nonsense. And we end up doing that right now the same way we did during 9/11. If you go back and listen to or watch our 9/11 coverage from way back when, it's just like this. Good, solid, sensible coverage that does not go down paths that we should not be taking into areas of pure speculation, paranoia, and fear-mongering. Not at all. That's not what Unknown Country is about. People who have close encounter experiences are in every way remarkable, and this website is intended to reflect that and to reflect you.
This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Joseph Farrell is back with us today after a long break for Joseph. He hasn't been on the show since August of 2019. Joseph's first experience of Dreamland and our first meeting came in 2009. If you can believe it, folks, Joseph's been coming on this show for a good long while. And the reason for that is, well, I mean, it's 2006, what I'm saying, not 2009. It was called Nazi UFO Secrets. If you're a subscriber, you can certainly listen to this and all the other Joseph Farrell shows that we have done. And I'm telling you this, they are quite an education. The most recent one was in January, actually, of 2019, when August of 2019. When we talked about child abuse and the human soul and the deep state, when we were talking about his book, McCarthy Marshall, and what is the rest of it, Joseph?
Well, the book we talked about was McCarthy Monmouth and the Deep State.
McCarthy Monmouth and the Deep State. And the right. Next one, the one we're going to touch on later in the show, is McCarthy Marshall
and the other International.
Roosevelt, Trotsky, Stalin, and America's Progressivist Deep State. The opposite, right. The other Deep State.
The other one.
Yeah, right. But we're going to review the situation as it stands in the eyes of Joseph Farrell right now with the social situation, the cultural situation, and the medical situation regarding coronavirus.
Right.
And so far today, just today, this show is going to air in about a week, but it is the 2nd of March, and Washington State has reported 6 deaths, 18 reported cases. Somewhat higher death rate than we had expected, for sure. Mm-hmm. So where do we start, Joseph?
Well, you know, this whole coronavirus thing, Whitley, I've been absolutely flooded in my email inbox with people sending me different articles about it. And from the looks of it to me, my first impression was when this story broke, and I really haven't changed my outlook on it, is a lot of it is hype. I'm not saying that the story isn't real. I think it's very real. But it's being hyped by the media. But it struck me when it first broke that this was some sort of bioeconomic warfare on China. And it certainly has crippled their economy. You know, they've shut down several provinces, many of them highly industrialized. And the other thing that strikes me is the geopolitical fallout from this is going to be sweeping, because it really puts a crimp. You know, nobody trusts the Chinese to begin with, but this really puts a crimp in their plans for the One Belt, One Road initiative.
Which is?
Well, that's their initiative to build out rail and infrastructure to make land links between the Orient and Europe. You know, link the whole Eurasian continent together through high speed rail and so on. And they've already run some trains, as a matter of fact, all the way from China to London. That was a couple of years ago that happened. But they've been planning this for some time. And, of course, Russia has its own plans to build out the northern routes in Siberia through a similar network of infrastructure. And, of course, Russia has been talking with Japan about this and with China. So that's the first thing that struck me, that this was going to put a huge geopolitical crimp in China's plans to do this. And the other thing I noticed, this was, I think, last week, Whitley, when the Chinese central bank announced that it was pulling currency from circulation and disinfecting it.
That was so weird, yeah.
Yeah, it was totally weird. And on top of that, they came out with another story, I think a couple days later, that they had authorized the printing of new currency to make up the shortfall. So in other words, they're hit in kind of a double whammy of a deflation inflationary cycle with this currency situation that this virus has put them in. So there's that factored into it. So, you know, my first impression is it's some sort of bioeconomic warfare. And now we're hearing stories that this has spread to Iran. There have been several high-ranking members of the Iranian government, I guess, that have succumbed. One a close advisor to the head Ayatollah.
Yeah, they were actually, one of them was actually sick on TV.
Yeah.
The deputy health minister.
Yeah.
It was utterly incredible. And then I read someone that in Iran, they don't believe he has coronavirus. They believe he was faking it. The Iranians do, because of course they believe nothing of their government, in order that he would be cured and it would be claimed that Iranian medicine was effective in curing him. In other words, the Iranian medical infrastructure was prepared, which of course is the Iranians I know who basically are here, but who have family there, say there is no medical infrastructure as far as they're concerned. And it's not entirely Iran's fault. Part of it is the fact that the sanctions have essentially crippled their ability to do things like buy medical supplies. So
right. Well, this has spread all the way to Italy now, too. There's reports that the Pope is sick. He's canceled a number of meetings and so on.
Yeah.
So I think this is some sort of geopolitical agenda behind it.
It's certainly an event. Now, could it be that a geopolitical agenda is emerging out of what is essentially a chance encounter with a virus? Or
sure, yes.
Yeah.
You know, this is my other concern, is if this was not staged, if it was indeed an accidental outbreak that, you know, began in Wuhan and then spread from there, it certainly looks to me, at least if you're sitting in Xi Jinping's chair, it looks to me like he has seized upon this as a crisis of opportunity to crack down and, you know, weed out some people within the Chinese Communist Party that he doesn't particularly like. So I'm thinking that he's certainly seized on it as a crisis of opportunity, and it looks to me certainly like you're seeing all the signs that it's being seized on, you know, by other actors on the world stage as a crisis of opportunity. We're already seeing reports about how this could lead to the introduction of a cashless currency and so on and so forth. So there's a lot going on.
Yeah, well, it's actually a world-changing event because, you know, the president has said the other day in his press conference that the virus will start to fade in April, which is probably true. I mean, if it's a normal coronavirus, it will back down as the heat rises in the northern hemisphere. It will anyway. But what then happens in these cases is the virus, two things happen. One is it starts to spike in the southern hemisphere when it gets warm, and it mutates over time.
Mm-hmm.
And in the fall, it will come back probably stronger, as is usually the case in with viruses like this, and also, as a matter of fact, with flu viruses, and be more dangerous, actually, in the fall than it is now.
Yeah, that could be. That could very well be. And I've seen other speculation out there now linking this thing to the 5G networks, because you had that very strange
Joseph, I hate to ask you, but are you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay. I've had this sinus going on ever since the weather started to change here, and it's been driving me nuts.
Good.
And it's interfering with my speech. But the other thing that has come out is this link to the 5G, because Wuhan was built out with a lot of 5G. Now the interesting thing, of course, is there are people speculating that the arrest of Dr. Lieber at Harvard University, who had ties with Wuhan and with the Institute of Virology or whatever it is there in Wuhan, but he was also working in an area trying to integrate nanotechnology into all of this. And there's speculation out there now, and I've indulged in a bit of it myself on my website, that this might be a virus that was triggered by electromagnetic signals, or at least that its effect was enhanced through the use of this. So I went back and dug out this paper. Somebody on my website sent me this paper of an Air Force study that one of the things that they were thinking about was the creation of a kind of biowarfare where the germ or the virus would lay dormant for a certain period of time, just like the coronavirus does, and is triggered by signals. In other words, you create an electromagnetic template that sets the thing in motion. So, you know, there's all sorts of speculation about this thing going on right now, and it is an event of some sort, but it's very difficult to read the tea leaves. But I do think the geopolitical fallout, given the fact that this has hit China so hard.
Yes.
And it appears, you know, the other thing about this virus is there are a number of articles that have also appeared that Chinese people or Oriental people in general have five times the lung receptors for this virus as the rest of the population of the globe. So in other words, it's going to hit Oriental peoples particularly hard.
I mean, you add to that 80% of the world's heavy smokers are in Asia.
In Asia,
You definitely got a problem. Free Dreamlanders, yeah. You don't have a problem, especially if you listen up. We'll be right back.
In 2015, Whitley Strieber entered a whole new level of contact, and his new book, A New World, tells the powerful and revealing story of what's been happening. Read about contact experiences unlike you have ever heard described before. Learn about the breakthroughs in communication that are developing right now. Experience the wonder of seeing into a mirror universe. The thrill of discovering the close encounter experience in an entirely new way. And learn the secret of how Whitley has built a very real and ongoing relationship with our otherworldly visitors. One Amazon reviewer says, a significant document of human empowerment. Another, one mind-bending, reality-shifting read. Another, outstanding. Get A New World today, available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold, and as an audiobook read by Whitley on audible.com.
We're talking to Joseph Farrell. His website, GizaDeathStar.com. That's GizaDeathStar.com. His new book, McCarthy, Marshall, and the Other International, Roosevelt, Trotsky, Stalin, and America's Progressivist Deep State. So we've got two deep state books in a row now, one on one side of the aisle and the other on the other. And we've talked about the one on the other side of the aisle. This time, this round, we'll talk about the one on this side of the aisle. But we'll be thinking in terms of an overarching tendency on the part of power to consolidate and conceal. But let's now go back to coronavirus and 5G. I think this is important because
yeah.
I don't believe that there has been any serious study of the health effects of 5G. But when you see a type of radiation that pulsates like that, I worry about it. I really worry about its effect on the immune system. Are you aware of any studies?
Well, this is a very interesting topic to me, Whitley. There are a few studies coming out of Europe. You know, they've done those tests in the Netherlands and in Belgium, and Belgium has, in fact, decided not to implement it. So, you know, right there in the heart of the EU, the Belgian government has said no to this.
Now, but what reasons did they give?
Well, here's the interesting thing. There was a test, apparently, of 5G, and I think this was a few months back, in the Netherlands. And as a result of the test, they discovered a bunch of birds had just fallen dead to the ground. And that brought back to my mind stories. I don't know if you remember the story of birds falling dead from the sky in Tennessee a couple of years ago.
I remember many bird fall stories that were unexplained.
Yep. And then there was another one in Idaho where a flock of geese just fell dead. And we were told at the time, particularly in the case of the Idaho story, we were told at the time that this was some sort of fast-acting bird flu. And I thought, no, that can't be. You know, you would have an incubation period, and, you know, some birds would fall from the sky at one point and others at another point.
Not in flocks, and that kept happening.
Right, and that's exactly what kept happening, these sudden die-offs of birds in flight. And my immediate thought, you know, back then was, well, no, this is some sort of electromagnetic weapon that has, as a result of whatever they've done with the weapon, has mimicked the symptoms of flu. And now, lo and behold, we're dealing with all of these speculations out there about coronavirus and 5G and the possible relationship between the two. I'm willing to crawl out on the end of this speculation twig and make the connection. I do think that it's possible that we might be looking at some sort of bioelectrical type of phenomenon here where they've engineered a virus and engineered it to respond to a certain type of electromagnetic template to exacerbate the effect of the virus or even kind of to kick it off. So I'm not ruling it out altogether, and I do think there might be a connection to these very strange stories that we saw of the birds, you know, just falling from the sky.
Well, of course, this being the United States, we're going to go all out for it, just like China, and nothing, no amount of danger, no matter how clear it is, will stop them.
Right.
Even if it kills us all, it's not going to stop them.
Yeah,
they'll deploy it anyway and then claim it wasn't their fault, even though they now have no customers left.
Well, the other thing here that is very strange with Whitley is that there are some stories that are hovering on the fringe of this coronavirus story. And let me mention two of them that are, to me, just very, very weird. On February 27th on my website, I blogged about the Utah goldback state currency. And as we know, Utah is one of those states like Texas that has adopted a resolution for, you know, constitutional or specie money. So a company that is connected to this in Utah has come out with these goldback currency things that are electro, by use of electrolysis, there's a minute amount of gold actually in this little sheet of paper or plastic or whatever it is. And I got reading about this, and lo and behold, you know, everybody says, well, where can we spend it? And I started looking up on their website, and one of the places that they had listed where that is trading this stuff is Hong Kong.
Oh, no.
And I thought, well, you know, this is hardly coincidental. You know, if you're going to introduce a currency and have it be traded, one of the logical places to do this, especially if you're concerned about communist China and Hong Kong and that whole situation there, is you're going to try and introduce it at Hong Kong. That's just exactly what they've done. And this is happening at the same time as this coronavirus outbreak. And then there's another story that's also making the rounds now in connection with the coronavirus, and that is that apparently there is something that has been promoted by the World Bank and so on in conjunction with the World Health Organization called pandemic bonds, where people are actually buying bonds and wagering money, essentially, in the casino of high finance, that if a pandemic breaks out, they lose their money, and if it doesn't break out, they don't lose their money. And so now we have this situation where some of these bonds are written against the possibility of a coronavirus outbreak. So they're hesitating. Some people are arguing they're hesitating to call it a pandemic because the people would have to have their bonds paid off if that's the case.
So, I mean, believe, you know, it just beggars imagination, and yet it's totally believable.
Yeah, it is. I mean, these people have already come up with weather derivatives, so why not pandemic bonds, you know?
That's right.
It's a case of the ultimate insider trading, Whitley, and this is what bothers me about this whole thing, is that all of these things are hitting at the same time, and let's add to this that several of China's sovereign securities are coming due right about this time, I think in July, along with some of these pandemic bonds, which are also due in July. So in other words, you know, they've hit China with a double whammy here, really a quadruple whammy when you factor in the central bank in China printing up new money to make up the shortfall of cash for disinfecting the money already in circulation. So, you know, you can't imagine a more well thought out scenario if you're thinking along the lines that this coronavirus outbreak is engineered. You really can't.
Well, I wonder about engineering. It does seem like and I've talked to some virologists about it. Mm-hmm. In fact, to be honest, in the interest of full disclosure, one virologist who no longer, he's retired, but I can't mention his name, mm-hmm. did work on viruses, created viruses as, or I should say, altering viruses into bioweapons. Mm-hmm. And he's not sure. He said there are so many different things that you can do. Mm-hmm. But one of the signatures of a bioweapon, interestingly enough, or of a weaponized virus, is that it has an incubation period when it is also contagious.
Right.
And this one does.
Right.
And what I've been looking for are coronaviruses that occur in nature that have incubation periods where the host is already contagious. And there are a few, but they're relatively rare. Mm-hmm. So I think it's possible it's engineered, but if so, it's been done very skillfully by somebody, such as somebody in one of those two labs in Wuhan, which everybody now knows about. And if you don't know about them, folks, there are two biological weapons-related biology labs in Wuhan. And in fact, I know someone who has an American who has been in one of those labs and says, in his opinion, it's the best managed bio lab he's ever seen. He said it's a highly safe lab. And he said, I can't believe anything could get out of that lab unintentionally.
Right.
So now, Free Dreamlanders, speaking of intention, you need to gather your intention together and do what these commercials suggest. We'll be right back.
Whitley's new book, A New World, is getting great reviews. American cosmic author Diana Walsh-Pasulka says, "Enter this risky new world and leave empowered." New York Times reporter Leslie Keen says, "Riveting. I couldn't put it down." Amazon reviewers are calling it life-changing, mind-opening, the first real description of what contact is like and will be like. Don't miss A New World. As Professor Jeffrey Kripal says in his preface, this book is contact. Get A New World today. Available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold. And as an audiobook read by Whitley on audible.com.
We're talking to Joseph Farrell. His website, GizaDeathStar.com, which has grown over the years as I have watched it into a big, active community. And it's a very interesting community, too. You won't find too many people in a community like that who are as knowledgeable as the people who come to Joseph's site, because Joseph operates on the fringe of possibilities. He's not a conspiracy theorist, but he's also open to things that other people are closed to, largely because of his skill as a researcher. And the people on the site have a tendency to have a very sophisticated vision as well. His new book is McCarthy, Marshall, and the Other International. And we'll be talking about that in a few minutes. Now, what I think personally is that this is probably not a manufactured virus, but simply because of the fact that it started right in the middle of the country that would have manufactured it. I think that there are two possibilities. One, it did escape from one of those labs or was taken out of one of those labs intentionally by a disgruntled employee, because, you know, we forget we're here in the United States. There are an awful lot of people in China who really hate their government.
Yes.
And with good reason.
Yeah.
That could have been done to as an intentional act of domestic terrorism very easily.
Well, I've entertained that thought too, Whitley, and I don't think it can be dismissed, because if we look at the way Xi has responded to it, he's responded to it by placing some of his very closest advisors into those provinces where the outbreak is most severe. So in other words, he's doubled down, because I think he is aware that his government, to a certain extent, is at stake here. And, you know, he's got his own internal opposition within the Communist Party and so on and so forth. So he's doubled down, and he's acting very much like this might have been some sort of domestic terrorism. And I, you know, since we're
designed to topple him by someone in the Communist Party at a high level who does not want him to stay where he is, because they don't want another Chairman Mao, which is what he's trying to become.
Right, exactly. This goes back to his announcement, I think it was last year, that, you know, made him essentially president for life. So there's that possibility, and I don't rule out the possibility, given the fact that we saw those stories about the Canadian virus lab in Winnipeg that had the Chinese spies within it.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's another story that appeared just on the cusp of this coronavirus outbreak. It appeared a few days before, where you had a couple of Chinese physicians there at the Canadian National Pathogen Lab in Winnipeg that were expelled because they had apparently been conducting espionage for Communist China inside the Canadian lab, which was, you know, a fairly sophisticated level 4 facility. And this, you know, this plus the arrest of Dr. Lieber at Harvard makes me think that there might have been some sort of warning or intelligence that something was going to happen. And I can't rule out that Western actors that were connected with the lab in Wuhan, and there certainly were those, Dr. Lieber being one of them, that there may have been Western intelligence that released this thing into China. So, you know, we could be looking at domestic terrorism by the Chinese themselves, some sort of opposition. We could be looking at a Western intelligence operation. Who knows?
But tell us a little bit more about the Charles Lieber arrest and why people would think that could be connected.
Well, I think it is connected, because this occurred, again, just on the cusp of the coronavirus outbreak story. He was arrested a few days before we first heard about the coronavirus outbreak, and he was arrested for not disclosing his ties to that Institute of Technology.
Wuhan University Institute of Technology, I think.
Yeah, that's right. That's what it was. So he had ties to this thing in Wuhan, where the virus breaks out. And again, he was conducting research into nanotechnology and bioweapons and so on and so forth. So there again, you know, you have another little indicator that maybe there's an electromagnetic component to this thing. The only place that argues against that is Iran, because they have not built out a 5G network in Iran.
But here's the thing that's so strange about Iran. It's so widespread there.
Yes.
No one knew it was even there until it was apparently everywhere.
Right.
And that stopped me. Because,
well, it stops me too, because if we're going to assume, Whitley, that there is a signaling component, as some of the people out there are arguing and speculating, if we're going to assume that, then there has to be another way to turn on the signal over the whole country of Iran, since they don't have a 5G network. So I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe they're beaming signals on Iran from space. Who knows? I don't know. But you're right. The widespread nature of it in Iran is very, very peculiar. And you have to wonder exactly then what was the vector that's transmitting it to Iran. And this is the other thing that, you know, we're not really being given a very clear picture in the media reports of all of this, what the vector really is. You know, was it food? Was it an accidental release from the laboratory in Wuhan? What's the nature of the connection between China and Iran?
Well, exactly. And because you can be sure that there were no one in Iran was eating bat soup. I mean,
right, exactly.
Or pangolins. I mean, let's face it. I mean, those are uniquely Chinese victuals. I mean, the pangolin, to be fair, is not. It's used as a medicinal. But bats are used in as a food in China. I'm having trouble even mentioning this. It's so disgusting.
It's really a kind of creepy thing to think about eating bats, but you know.
But what happened? How did this virus expel itself into Iran so deeply, especially when there isn't a lot of movement of people between Iran and China? It's not like Africa, which has a very large number of Chinese working there and moving back and forth all the time. And yet in Africa, there's so far little has been reported. It could be deeply involved in Africa, and it'll take a long time for it to be reported. That's true. But it's just something is just way off.
It's way off because there's no known vector for it. And food certainly can't be it because, you know, as you say, the Iranians don't eat bats. You know, they've got Islamic halal laws that would, you know, prohibit that sort of thing to begin with. So exactly, what's the vector from China to Iran?
Well, that's the thing that worries me the most, quite frankly, because there's another, you know, Free Dreamlanders, listen up. And listen, why don't you really ditch the whole Free Dreamland thing and go over to the site and subscribe, because if you did that, we would finally have enough money to build out an app that you could use to listen all the time on, instead of having to listen wherever you are listening, or on Alexa or iTunes or Apple Podcasts or Paranormal or KGRA. We'd have our own app, and you could help us do that. Anyway, we'll be right back.
Whitley Strieber became the host of Dreamland in 1998, and he's still the host today. One of the first podcasts, Dreamland has been built into the premier program of its kind, exploring the edge of science and reality. The show's archive on unknowncountry.com dates back to 2004. Dreamland is a treasure unique in the world. Help keep us on the air by subscribing to unknowncountry.com today. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab. Dreamland, where wonder is spoken.
We're talking to Joseph Farrell, his website, GizaDeathStar.com, his new book, McCarthy, Marshall, and the Other International. That is it. Okay. So we're going to go back to Iran now and the missing vector, because something spread that disease around in that country extensively. It's right. not just isolated. You would think that it would be in one city or another, but it's apparently all over the country, and people are dying like flies. More deaths in Iran than in any other country. Right. I just worry about that. That does look like a bio-warfare act to me.
Well, precisely. This is why the Iranian aspect of the story is what convinces me we're looking at some sort of bio-warfare crisis of opportunity at the minimum. Because if you look at this,
yeah, at the minimum,
they're targeting China, they're targeting Iran, and everybody else is just kind of collateral damage. And most interestingly, Whitley, there's one country that has very, very little reportage of coronavirus, and that's Russia.
And Russia also has one of the most, if not the most sophisticated bioweapons infrastructure in the world. We are not close to where they are in terms of engineering bioweapons. And another thing that my friend, I hate when I say, have to say, use a anonymity on this show, but I don't have any choice here, said, I said, well, what is the signature of a weaponized virus? He said, the best signature of a weaponized virus is it goes where it's supposed to go and it doesn't look like it's weaponized.
Yep.
And where is it? It's in China and it's in Iran.
Iran, yeah. Yeah. And these, you know, this is why I lean, at least at present, Whitley, toward the view that this was something cooked up by somebody in the West.
Or in Russia. I mean,
It could be Russia. You know, Russia, and I'm glad you mentioned that possibility, because if you're in Mr. Putin's shoes and you're trying to build out the Russian version of the Silk Road and expand the Trans-Siberian and create a new Arctic route and so on, and trunk lines and so on and so forth, you've either got to go to one of three places for the capital and the technology to do it. You've got to go to the United States for the capital, or to China or Japan for the capital and the technology. And in fact, if you look at the Russian geostrategic position with trying to build out Siberia, the last thing you want is over-reliance on China to do it. So they've been playing with Japan, as you and I both know, for quite some time, and negotiating some very quiet deals with Japan. And I suspect that if you're in Mr. Putin's shoes, you may want to trim the wings of China just a bit, and possibly also of Iran as well.
And of Japan, for that matter.
And of Japan, yeah.
It's certainly falling right into their hands, and so far there seems to be very little, if any, coronavirus in Russia.
That's right. That's right.
Which is strange.
It's very, very strange. Now,
Being Russia, it could be that the entire country is completely polluted by it and they're not telling anybody. I mean,
that could be, but I think we would probably know if it was the case, because, you know, Russia's kept the borders open for Western tourists and so on. We'd probably hear of something by now. But it's intriguing to me that shortly after this outbreak began, that Russia, just like Trump, closed the borders to Chinese travelers, which was a very unusual thing to do, you know, since they're supposedly allies. So something's going on. And the other interesting thing, while we're on the subject of the geopolitics of the region in connection with this story, is Japan's response to this is very unusual, because they're not quarantining anybody. Their approach is, okay, it's here, we know it's here, so what we're going to try and do is just heal people of it rather than quarantine. So they're taking a very different approach to this whole thing in Japan as from what they're doing in China. So they appear not to be terribly alarmed by it, but by the same token, they're concerned enough about it. So something is going on here, and to me, the fact that this Iran part of the story just began to break within the last couple of weeks, to me, this is the dead giveaway. We're dealing with a scenario, with something that somebody wants to achieve through this.
The thing is, you have to look at who this is helping.
Right.
And it's actually, it's to an extent helping the United States, but it's a very mixed bag. It is China's expansion into the Pacific is going to be affected by this.
Yes.
But our economy is going to be hurt close to as badly as theirs by the trade disruptions that are taking place.
Well, I think the long-term benefit to the United States here is if there was any doubt about having your factories in China and so on and so forth, that doubt's removed, and they're going to have to reshore the supply line of stuff that's still over there. So this is the long-term hit. This is the long-term implication to this story that I think it's going to be the final impetus, really, to reshore all that industry. And I think it's also very, very interesting, Whitley, in this regard, that we see Trump over in India, as all of this is going on, talking with Prime Minister Modi.
And coming away, amazingly enough, without a trade deal.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Which amazed me. I mean, he went all the way over there and comes – a president doesn't go to a country like that and not come back with something in his – something to show for it.
Right.
It really amazed me. The whole thing was a debacle.
Too, because it indicates either they're working out something long-term or the trade deal was a cover to get over there and talk about other issues entirely. And, given the Iran outbreak, given the tensions between India and Pakistan and India and China, I have to wonder if there may have been another agenda to that whole thing altogether.
Well, that's interesting because I hadn't thought of that. But then again, I'm not a geopolitical thinker. I'm in an entirely different space. Most of my thinking has nothing to do with this planet at all. So tell us why that would – what would be the motive there?
Well, given the timing of that summit in the midst of this coronavirus story, and given all the little indicators that there was something that they were planning that looks like the outbreak itself, I think that maybe the reason for that trip may have been to cement some strategic concerns, to doke out the broad outlines of American-Indian cooperation strategically, militarily, in the Indian Ocean, in the South China Sea, and so on, places where both countries have obvious interests. And the other thing that, that places your observation about no trade deal into a big spotlight is the fact that a few years ago, let's recall, that Iran worked out bilateral currency swaps with India on the basis of the rupee and the Iranian currency, that they would trade directly with each other and bypass the dollar.
That's right. I remember that.
It may have had something to do with that as well, which again may have been one reason that we haven't been told about it, because any negotiations along those lines would have been very, very secret. So my suspicion is we're going to hear something down the line about India and the United States in terms of strategic thinking and working out arrangements, memoranda of understanding, and so on and so forth. I don't think we're going to hear about it, though, for some time until after this first phase of the virus story is over. That's my thinking, at least at the moment.
But it'll be interesting to see if that comes true and if what we do hear, because I know that there's a lot of unrest in India.
Yes.
A lot of friction has been generated between the Hindus and the Muslims because of the policies that have been adopted by the Modi government, which are designed to create that friction.
Yes.
They're designed to foment trouble between the two religious groups. And I just cannot imagine what the motive is, except it's the same motive that every Hitler had. I mean, to create a straw man in the Jews, which he did, but the Muslim population of India is no straw man.
No,
you could end up in a civil war situation very easily there.
Yeah, you could, with the tensions in the region, with all of the stuff going on, with the negotiations with the Taliban and so on, You know, India is going to have a stake in it. And this is my other suspicion. You know, I mentioned the Taliban deliberately here because the Trump administration is concluding these agreements with the Taliban in Afghanistan. Well, at some point, you know, that's right on India's doorstep, right next door to Kashmir, which has always been the hotbed of contention between India and Pakistan. So my other suspicion is that his going over there had something to do with these negotiations with the Taliban too, and he was giving a heads up, you know, personally to Modi, which was probably the correct thing to do under the circumstances. So there's any number of ways to play this. But I do think that we're going to hear something about this meeting and American-Indian relations over the long term. I don't think that he came away empty-handed, but I don't think that we're in a position yet where they're ready to reveal whatever it is that they really worked out and talked about. But it's going to play out one way or the other.
Yeah, you know, it occurs to me that a president wouldn't go into a situation like that expecting it. He knew before he left what he was going to do. They always do.
Right.
He knew that there would be no trade deal. And when he came back, he seemed quite indifferent about it. And in fact, before he went, he didn't speak much about a trade deal. So
right.
It was almost like it was a cover of some kind. That's
very true. I think so.
Okay, well now, let's move on, but before we do that, Free Dreamlanders, you move on over to Unknown Country and subscribe. We'll be right back.
Unknown Country and Dreamland are unique in every way. The site offers over 16,000 news stories dating back 20 years, all of them with our uniquely open-minded and yet carefully researched point of view. You can find stories of everything from lost cities to multiple witness high strangeness events to the cutting edge of science and reality on the site. For subscribers, the site offers a wealth of material that is mind-opening and can be life-changing. Plus, there are active comment sections, both in the free area and the subscriber area, and a free weekly newsletter. Dreamland, which Whitley Strieber has been hosting for over 20 years, is archived on the site back to 2004. This archive is the only one of its kind in the world, an incredible richness of information that offers exciting adventure every time you dig in. So go to unknowncountry.com daily, get our newsletter, participate in the site's social groups, and above all, subscribe and join this unique community today. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the Subscribe tab to see our options.
We're talking to Joseph Farrell today. His website, GizaDeathStar.com. His new book, McCarthy Marshall and the Other International. And I have to get on to this remarkable book. Now, first, why don't you just give us an idea of what the two books together are about? Because we've already talked on Dreamland about the first one, but probably a lot of our listeners did not hear that Dreamland. So,
well, the books are born out of a conclusion I came to a few years ago that there was something going on in the post-war period during what I've come to call the committee era. And by the committee era, I'm referring, of course, to McCarthy, McCarran, Kefauver, you know, the House Un-American Activities Committee, the Rees Committee on the Foundations, Corporate Foundations. If you look at that era, Whitley, from the post-war period up through the Army-McCarthy hearings in 1954 and even beyond, you know, into the Kefauver Committee about the mob, all these committees were investigating some aspect of the penetration of the federal government by other countries' interests, the Soviet Union with McCarthy and so on. With the Rees Committee, you had the influence of corporate foundations on the federal government, Kefauver investigating the mob and, you know, all of this stuff. And I've never been satisfied with any of the histories of the various committees of that era because it strikes me that they're looking at them with blinders on. In other words, they're not trying to connect the dots between all of these various committees and what they were doing and why they were doing it. And against this backdrop, you had, of course, course, the Roosevelt administration, bringing in a lot of people that later turned out to be Soviet spies, Alger Hiss being the most famous, but we now know, thanks to the Venona transcripts, that it's very likely that Harry Hopkins, Roosevelt's closest advisor, was a Soviet agent of influence. Harry Dexter White, the man that basically formulated the post-war international financial order, was also very likely, from the Venona transcripts, a Soviet agent, and so on and so forth. So it looks to me, if you want to look at this against the backdrop of what I've posited with the Nazi International, if you look at Senator McCarthy's own connections to that sort of philosophy, you know, he had people like Robert McCormick of the Chicago Tribune backing him. He had the Harnischweger family in Wisconsin, which was a family with clear Nazi sympathies. He had his connection to the Texas oilmen, who, as we know, had their own German connections.
Yes.
Yeah,
you're talking to somebody who knows an awful lot about that. Too much.
So you have, to me, what it looks like is a kind of warfare, factional warfare, being played out in the committee era between those people who were backing the Soviet experiment and those people who are backing the fascist experiment. And I got digging into this, and what set off the first book, as you know, was when I got a hold of the Monmouth transcripts that McCarthy's committee was holding, investigating Soviet penetration at Fort Monmouth in New Jersey. And the thing that set that book off was I read those transcripts, Whitley, and it's important for people to understand that these transcripts were only declassified by the United States Senate in 2003. And they're quite a read, let me tell you, because you get the normal McCarthy thing. Have you ever been a member of the Communist Party, or did you know Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, and so on and so forth? But what really touched me off was there were constant references to July of 1947, in other words, to the Roswell period. There were constant references to whatever was going on in New Mexico in connection with Fort Monmouth, and on this went. And then there was the curious episode of finding out that the U.S. Army had turned over massive amounts of occupation money plates to the Soviet Union, and this at the request of Harry Dexter White. And, you know, McCarthy was all over that. So I thought, well, there's something more going on here with the senator from Wisconsin than meets the eye. And then the second book was literally caused by me having one of those oh my God moments as I'm pottering around the house here. And I literally slapped my palm against my forehead, Whitley, because McCarthy had written a book. He gave his famous speech on the floor of the Senate about General Marshall in June of 1951. And basically, it's an interesting speech, because what he's doing is he's calling into question the judgments that General Marshall made during World War II that seemed to do nothing but benefit the Soviet Union. And you know, you think typical McCarthy stuff. But then, at the height of the Army-McCarthy hearings, he publishes a book, which is basically an edited version of the speech he gave in 1951. And it's called America's Retreat from Victory. And in the book version of his speech, he adds more information. And You have to sit back and just put it in the context of the Army-McCarthy hearings, which were going on in 1954. Because in the book, he goes through a history of Marshall's rise to power, and he points out that the individual, the one individual that is responsible for promoting Marshall to Roosevelt's attention and leapfrogging him over much more senior officers that eventually Marshall is the one from colonel to brigadier general, and then all of a sudden to chief of staff, you know, a five-star general under Roosevelt. He points out something very interesting. He points out that the individual who influenced Roosevelt the most to make that decision was Harry Hopkins.
Huh.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, whoa, that's a bombshell. That's a bombshell, especially at the height of the Army-McCarthy hearings. And then he refers to a work in the book version of his speech. He refers to a work by George Morgenstern on Pearl Harbor, which was, of course, after the war was investigated to the hilt by these committees. And Morgenstern came to the conclusion very, very early on that, you know, Roosevelt and Marshall and Hopkins and all of the top people in the administration knew about the Japanese attack and didn't really do anything to prevent it. And, you know, Morgenstern's book for Pearl Harbor revisionism stands in kind of the same relationship as Harold Weisberg's work on the Kennedy assassination.
Folks, let me just stop here for just one second, Joseph. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but there's a little geopolitical perspective that we need here. Going back to World War II, prior to Japan getting into the war, the United States would have concentrated all of its energy, if it even got into the war at all, against the Nazis in Europe. And
Right. The
result of this would have been that it would have taken – the Soviets would have taken far less of Europe than they actually got.
Right.
And so when we got into the war in the Pacific, that ensured that we would not be such a factor in Europe, and the Russians would go as far west as they could. And Churchill was well aware of this. And I believe it was at the Yalta Conference or the one before that, that he protested to Roosevelt. About that. He protested that there was too much materiel and manpower going into the Far East rather than into Western Europe.
Well, this I'm glad you mentioned that, because this is something that McCarthy brought out both in his 1951 Senate speech and then later embellished in the book version of it. And that is that Marshall launched that invasion of southern France, Operation Anvil, in August of 1944, over the objections of General Mark Clark, the American commander of Allied forces in Italy, and over the objections of Winston Churchill, who wanted to move from northern Italy directly into Yugoslavia and just basically unhinge the Nazi military effort on the Eastern Front. And that move would have prevented the Soviets from moving into Eastern Europe as they did at the end of the war. So
right.
In other words, you know, this is something that he's very alive to in the book.
And we were absolutely not where we needed to be at that point because of what happened in southern France.
Right, exactly. Now, the interesting thing is that in the book version of the speech, and it's very important for people to understand that McCarthy, I think, timed this book to come out in 1954. Now, by accident, I think it comes out more or less during the middle of the Army-McCarthy hearings. But it was fortuitous timing on his part, because what he's doing is he's sending a direct salvo across the bow of the Eisenhower administration and the U.S. Army, and here's why. He points out in the book that Marshall had changed his story on where he was during the Pearl Harbor attacks twice. And then he goes on to mention something that just floored me when I read it. He cites a book, a biographical book, by Arthur Upton Pope on the Soviet ambassador to the United States at a certain point during the war by the name of Maxim Litvinov. And he points out that Upton says that Marshall had met Litvinov at the Washington airport on the day of Pearl Harbor. And this has totally dropped out of history. So in other words, what McCarthy's doing, and he's also pointing out that Marshall had definite foreknowledge of Pearl Harbor and so on and so forth. So what he's doing was he's saying, we can take this, and imagine dropping this right in the middle of the Armey and McCarthy hearings. We can take this much further. We can go into an investigation of the whole Pearl Harbor matter. We can go into an investigation of the Soviet influence possibly at work in Marshall's appointment, and on we go. So it was a huge bombshell to be dropping at that time. You know, it gets lost because, of course, you had that famous confrontation between the Army Counsel, Joseph Welch, and Senator McCarthy on television that everybody saw that basically ended McCarthy's career. But up to that point, it's important for people to understand that those hearings had drug on for weeks. They had been projected to end, you know, within a week or so, but they had drug on. And they were mostly kind of stalemated up till that point. So this was a huge bombshell that's got lost to history. And then I dug more, and I found out something, again, that just floored me. During the Soviet purge trials in the 1930s, we all know the story that Stalin basically got rid of a bunch of his opposition, basically the old Bolsheviks, you know, Lenin's old Politburo. Stalin used those trials to basically liquidate that element of the party. And, of course, Leon Trotsky was kind of the head or figurehead of that wing of the Bolshevik party. And Trotsky, of course, at the time, in the late 30s and up to 40, was in the United States, and Trotsky in Mexico, and he demanded that a hearing or commission, an international commission, be established so that he could defend himself against the charges that were being made against him by the purge trials. So a commission was established. This is not well known to most Americans, but a commission was established to investigate the claims of the purge trials and to let Trotsky answer them. And it was chaired by none other than John Dewey. And they go down to Mexico, and they interview Trotsky, and I go into this in that second McCarthy book and cite some of the transcripts. They go into interview Trotsky at his home in Mexico. This is before Stalin's assassins had him assassinated. And one of the people on the commission is guess who? In fact, she's the one that draws up the final report of the Dewey Commission. And her name is Suzanne La Follette.
Okay. Tell us who this is.
Now, you know who that is.
I know who it is, but I'm sure some of my listeners don't.
When McCarthy first ran for Senate, he unseated a sitting U.S. senator from the very powerful Wisconsin La Follette family by the name of Robert La Follette, Jr. And Suzanne La Follette was his cousin. So in other words, there's an aspect of the McCarthy story that few people even know exists, and that is that he was probably aware, meaning Senator McCarthy, he was probably aware of the Dewey Commission, of its findings, of its assertions, and so on and so forth, and aware of this Trotsky relationship between the La Follette family and Leon Trotsky, which is very, very interesting to me because, you know, the more you probe, the more strange things that you find out intersect in Senator McCarthy. Now, before I drop the next bombshell on you, I want to go back and remind people of what I said in the first McCarthy book, that he was approached, according to Roy Cohn himself, who I like to refer to as kind of the original swamp creature. Well, he was. I mean, there's just no two ways about it. But Roy Cohn tells the story that McCarthy was actually approached after he had been elected senator, that he had been approached by three members of military intelligence. And my suspicion is that they were Army, Navy, and Air Force. In other words, the three service branches. That they had drawn up a short list of four senators to bring this issue of Soviet infiltration into the public eye, and McCarthy was on the list. Well, when you look at McCarthy now, from this point of view, that you have this La Follette-Trotsky connection, that McCarthy goes after La Follette, that he's backed by people like Robert McCormick, the Kennedys, and so on. Let's not forget that connection. That it looks to me like he was definitely selected, very carefully vetted. Now, here's the clincher, Whitley, that just floored me. Let's go back to Harry Dexter White. Harry Dexter White appears in the Venona transcripts, and it's very clear that he's probably the one that some of these transcripts are referring to as an agent of influence. But after White got his doctorate in economics from Harvard, guess where he went to be on the faculty of a college? He went to the faculty of Lawrence College in, here it comes, Appleton, Wisconsin, McCarthy's hometown.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Now, none of this makes the public narrative. None of it makes the public narrative. These are little forgotten nuggets of history, but to me, they do indicate that there's much more going on in the background of why McCarthy may have been approached by this group of people that Cohn talks about. And, you know, just to bring it up to speed here, let's not forget who else is connected with Roy Cohn, our current president.
That's right. And tell how that is.
Well, Cohn was a fixer in New York City. If you did any business at all in New York City, especially in real estate, you had to deal with the mob. You had to deal with the political machine there. So Cohn was basically one of the fixers, and Donald Trump knew Cohn very well, was very close to him. And what's very interesting to me, I don't know if you're familiar with a lady by the name of Diana West, who wrote a book called The Red Thread.
No, I'm not.
Oh, you should read this book, Whitley, and your listeners should read this book, because she points out that many of the people going after Trump, like Comey, Bruce Orr, Nellie Orr, and so on and so forth, Christopher Steele, have all one thing in common. They all flirted at one time or another in their early life with communism.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
You know,
so
we have reached a point in the show which I must stop you for a minute and say goodbye to the Free Dreamlanders. Because in the next half hour, it's just you, me, and our subscribers, and we're going to be whispering about all kinds of things that you Free Dreamlanders wish to hell you had heard. Among other things, we're going to circle back to the late 40s and early 50s when these agents of influence were involved in our national affairs, and in particular, and even during the war, which, of course, during the war, the Russians were our allies, and Stalin in the United States was called Uncle Joe, and we didn't think about his purges or any of the awful things he had done at all. So, but then that reemerged later when we began to come to our senses and face the fact that he was not only a dictator, but a monster. Worse than Hitler in many respects. But there's a little personal story here that I'm going to tell about what happened to me when I was involved in this strange, weird program for children that we've talked about many times on this show. But there's one thing that I've never talked about that I'm going to ask Joseph about, because he might have an answer to a very, very burning, deep question that has been in my mind for many years. Free Dreamlanders, thank you so much for being with us. And yes, this is a shameless come on, so subscribe. We'll see you next week if you don't.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.